Okay, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I am your host, Pierce Redman, and you can find this podcast and every other podcast free for download by going to porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com, and also by going to my YouTube channel, which I hope you do subscribe to, which is youtube.com/1138porkins. Well, everybody, today we are joined by two of my favorite guests, Tom Secker of Clandestime and SpyCulture.com, and Sibel Edmonds, who, of course, is the founder of BoilingFrogsPost.com, the author of two books, Classified Woman, as well as her new book, which we recently spoke to Sibel about, which is The Lone Gladio. And Sibel and Tom are joining us again on the show to kind of pick up where we left off last time, where we were had a roundtable discussion about Gladio, and we're going to get into a whole lot more detail and different aspects of it. But first, Tom and Sibel, thank you both so much for joining me on the show again.
Well, thank you for the invitation, and it's such a pleasure. I really enjoy this discussion, and I love the fact that it provides a good forum outlet for people to listen to these topics, which I know are not covered by any other outlets. And I'm talking about the so-called alternative outlets. I think other than us, I really haven't found any other outlets that really go into the issue of Operation Gladio, the macro pictures of this geopolitical chess game. And so it's great to see that I'm not alone. And there are people like you and Tom Secker, both with expertise and interest in the area. And I'm also happy on behalf of people who get a chance to hear things that I know they are not going to hear anywhere else, period.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's why this is so important to continue talking about Operation Gladio and what's going on in Central Asia and the Caucasus, because it is so important and there is a severe lack of good information out there. But picking up where we sort of left off, we kind of ended, Sibel, with your sort of take on Russia's sort of not doing very much in the face of NATO's expansion in and around the traditional Russian sphere of influence. And you spoke about the notion that you had sort of heard these rumors from people who I would only assume would have a good sort of inside knowledge of this, that a lot of this had to do with the oft-used Gladio practice of blackmail, that there might be bank accounts in Cyprus, and you also pointed to Malta, where Putin might be depositing quite a large sum of money, and that, you know, for all intents and purposes, Operation Gladio, NATO, the CIA, they sort of know about this, and that this is sort of one of the things that kind of holds Russia back from sort of pursuing, you know, confronting Gladio, because obviously Russia has to know a great deal about what is actually going on. And at the end of that, I sort of mentioned Russia propping up Abkhazia and South Ossetia as sort of a response to NATO. But I thought we could kind of start first by kind of expanding on this idea and, you know, starting with me and Tom kind of explaining how we see this developing. And I wanted to sort of pick up on the idea that Russia, in reality, knows what's going on, obviously, but that they sort of allow this to go on to a degree, and that they're allowing this sort of stuff for several reasons. And I think that the blackmail issue obviously plays a huge part in this, and obviously there is a lot of dirt on everybody involved in here, and no one really wants to you know, lose the power that they have. But I see, again, the sort of reluctance from Russia as being a bit more cosmetic. Whereas in reality, as with all geopolitics, there's a lot more nuance to this. So I wonder if, you know, Russia sort of allows this to go on to kind of exploit the situation however they can, and also to gain intelligence, because obviously they can't know everything that's going on with Gladio. And in the overall scheme of things, I think Russia in general plays the long game as opposed to America, which is seems very intent on short-term goals. So Russia is kind of, you know, biding their time. And of course, I think in the intelligence world, where it's all about secrecy, you know, you never say what you know, even when you absolutely know what's going on. And to kind of expand on this and to use as a case study, I thought we could look at the detainment of Ayman al-Zawahiri by the FSB, which happened around 1996 when he was traveling into Chechnya. Now, for anyone that doesn't know, Zawahiri was held for about 6 months. He was interrogated, presumably pretty harshly. Was probably tortured by the FSB. They seized his laptop, amongst some other things, and then suddenly, after 6 months of being held, he was mysteriously released and was even given back his laptop, which Russia claims to be unable to translate the documents that were on it, which were in Arabic. They got no useful intelligence from this at all. I wouldn't really buy that story at all. I'm sure that they that they absolutely translated everything, and you know, probably made copies of it. And of course, that you know, there were these sort of idiotic claims that there was some sort of deal made between the FSB and Al Qaeda. This was picked up recently. I think just last year there was a Business Insider article which went into all sorts of conspiracy theories about Russia and Al Qaeda, and groups such as the Jamestown Foundation, which we've spoken about on this podcast before, as an obvious CIA front, has also sort of gone along with this. Of course, neither of them mention where Zawahiri got four different passports, all with different names. They never really pick up on the fact that along with Zawahiri, another person was detained with him, Ahmad Salama Mabruk, who ran operations for Zawahiri's Islamic Jihad group in none other than Azerbaijan, which is an obvious NATO Gladio proxy. But, you know, I sort of wonder if this isn't the kind of strategy that Russia uses a lot of the time in terms of what's going on with Gladio, that they'll sort of allow for NATO and, you know, Gladio operatives to sort of do that. And, you know, they'll enter in there and then they'll take them and then they'll sort of question them, get as much information as they can, and then release them. Because seemingly, if you or I captured Zawahiri, I'm sure we could get a lot of information from him. But it is odd that they just sort of then let him leave, along with his laptop, where, you know, God only knows what was on there. And I wonder if this is sort of a question of, you know, you're better off with the devil you know than the devil you don't know. Obviously, at this point in time, Zawahiri in the late 1990s was working very closely with NATO. And it seems that, you know, Russia, if they really wanted to, they could have kept him forever. They could have executed him. They could have done any number of things. But it seems like a lot of this is sort of letting them go back out and then kind of following up on them, figuring out where they're going, what they're doing, and trying to piece together this sort of overall picture. And I think, as we'll discuss later on in the podcast, there are some similarities between that sort of action and what happened with some of the Boston bombers, which Russia knew quite a bit about, especially the older brother. But I don't know, Tom, maybe you want to jump in here and, you know, either comment on that or sort of add your own sort of ideas about, you know, how Russia has been reacting in the face of NATO. Because it seems that, at least to me, that, again, this is more sort of a long game approach and that they're not going to go out and really necessarily confront what's going on, but that they will sort of allow for these things to go on and, of course, work within the, you know, quote, war on terror paradigm. Because, you know, for all intents and purposes, it can be beneficial to Russia at certain times. So, Tom, if you want to pick up on there, and then Sibel, jump in whenever you want to.
Okay. I mean, on the Zawahiri arrest and detainment by Russia in particular, you've, as always, you've got to look at context. So what is the context in Russia at that time? At that point, their state was just starting to turn around and start to recover from the massive collapse in the early 90s. They weren't in a position to be going off on, you know, imperial conquests or anything like that. So they were never going to do that in response to finding out that this Gladio A was shifting into Gladio B. I have no doubt that that's why Zawahiri was arrested at that point, you know? Mm. It's because they got wind of this. They thought, we need to know about this. Who do we know who's a likely operative on a senior level? Ayman Zawahiri. So, you know, no coincidence he then ends up in a Russian prison for 6 months, getting God knows what happening to him. So you have that. You also have, I suppose, by that point, the first Yugoslavian war, the first war in Bosnia, has effectively finished, and that is very much a war in which Russia were supporting one side and NATO were supporting another. NATO were, of course, supporting the Bosnian Muslims. And that is, again, a sort of, if you like, a precursor to Gladio B. That sort of operation strings, it links together what happened in Afghanistan with what's going on now under Gladio B. So you have that as part of the context as well. So what was Russia in a position to really do about this at the time? They didn't have the facility, they didn't have the intelligence, they didn't have the stability of state to go and actually directly counter this from a kind of intelligence point of view, you know, go and infiltrate Gladio B and try and screw it up. So what do? They get hold of the highest ranking operative they can, hang on to him for as long as they think they can get information out of him, and then let him go again, because they have no real reason to keep him permanently. And let's face it, if they kept him permanently, it might have become a bit of a sticking point because, you know, NATO wanted him back. So that would be my view on that. In terms of the overall Russian strategy, again, you've got to see it. It's Russia is not the same state that the United States is over the last 25 years. The last 25 years have been vastly, vastly different for Russia in terms of their economic situation, in terms of their capacity to actually do these sorts of things. The notion that Russia would, would have countered the 2003 invasion of Iraq in a military sense is ridiculous. That's not how Russians do things. That's not how they approach. That's not really how they've ever operated, even when they were an imperial state and even when they were the Soviet Union. They didn't really launch that kind of action. So when you look at how Russians wage war, how Russia as a state wages war, look at that very short war in Georgia a few years ago. They just went in there, proved their point, because that's all they were there to do, and then went away again. It's not like, you know, these ridiculous wars that NATO gets involved in, where we're stuck in countries for 15 years and we're not even sure what it is we're trying to accomplish anymore. Or at least none of the public has any idea what we're trying to accomplish in Afghanistan anymore. No one could, you know, really explain what the aim is anymore. But Russians don't get involved in that kind of thing. The one obvious exception being Afghanistan, and that whole thing was, you know, something they were kind of, to a certain extent, suckered into, and it was utterly stupid. That was a complete miscalculation on their part. And every once in a while, I suppose they do things like that. But you know what I mean. This just isn't the Russian strategy. Their strategy is to sit there, look at NATO, and say, "Let's figure them out. Let's figure out what they're going to do." And if it actually comes to our border, like it did in Ukraine, they responded. They had a contingency plan. They said, "If NATO takes Ukraine, we're going to take Crimea." And that's what happened. NATO causes this, or at least encourages, supports, somehow helps to bring about this putsch in Ukraine. We get the neo-Nazis and the rest of them in Kiev almost instantly, and without a lot of fuss, Russia just executes its contingency strategy. It annexes Crimea. It now actually has more territory than it had before. So this is how they do things, I think, a lot of the time, is they sit there, they watch, they have contingencies in place, they have plans in place, because this is how you play chess. You think, if they move like that, I will respond in this way. And we keep seeing this playing out time and time again. So, yeah, that's kind of my basic thinking on on those questions.
Yeah, and quickly, just Sibel, before you jump in there, I do wonder, too, if Russia isn't kind of blackmailing Gladio with some information. Obviously, even the information that was on Zawahiri's laptop, while it's probably very out of date right now, I'm sure that there are bits and pieces of that no one really wants to see the light of day. So again, we get into the blackmail sort of issue, and I'm sure that, you know, Russians are blackmailing, you know, Western sources as well. But Sibel, do you want to respond to any of that, or
oh yes,
you know, expand?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, this is exactly, I would say, number one reason I love this discussion with both of you, Tom Sacker. You just nailed it. I mean, and that is what I call true analysis and critical thinking, saying, okay, we are talking about this event, Ayman al-Zawahiri, but guys, let's just take a step back and see when it happened. That's extremely important, the point that Tom, you just made. And he's absolutely right. You're looking at during this era, this is about about almost a year before officially Gladio B took off. And then look and see what was happening during this period with Russia. I mean, you're looking at 5 years since the since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that's again extremely important. And within this context, he again nailed it by saying, "Look what was happening during that time. This is during Clinton, and we had all the Kosovo and Bosnia, and what was happening there." And so I think Tom just nailed all the good sound reasons, because a lot of people, They separate the events from context and the time period when it took place. And that's when you start getting either the wrong conclusion or you're completely off. So that was a beautiful way of providing some very good plausible reasons of what happened. And I agree with Tom. And in addition to that, there are some other ingredients as well. Once every few years, you know, we see on the headlines how they rounded up the U.S. government, 8 Russian spies. Remember this happened? Some of them were posing as business people and they were shipping them back to Russia. You know, those kinds of diplomatic incidents. When I was working that short period of time at the FBI with many nations, including Russians, we had on average 1 or 2 major operations of identifying and figuring out some active operatives, okay? Agents, some of them with diplomatic covers, you know, whether from Russia or you had some, you know, from Israel, etc. In 99.9% of the cases, you never read about those. A lot of things gets to be handled quietly, you know, because what happens is at any given time, Russia's intelligence or Chinese intelligence, they uncover and they know of U.S. operatives within their soil. So one of the diplomatic games, dances that takes place is, you know, fine, we figured out your guy, you know, we're going to have him get the F out of here quietly. We're not going to make a big deal because, hey, we know that you know at least about 3 of our people. You have uncoded our stuff and we want you to keep quiet about that. So that kind of diplomatic dance takes place on daily basis when you are working and seeing counterintelligence operations and both the CIA's and the FBI. So going back to Zawahiri, you just mentioned about the man traveled with 4 passports. Well, we talked about very, lightly about Susurluk incident in Turkey and this character who was based in Chicago, the Turkish guy Çatlı. Çatlı had 6 passports, okay? And out of 6, 4 of these passports were diplomatic passports. And these were not fake passports. These were real diplomatic passports. And one of the things that we have to remember, same thing applies with Ayman al-Zawahiri. When you're looking at the top operatives of Gladio working, a lot of these people, including Ayman al-Zawahiri, these were not also regular passports. He possessed diplomatic passports. And with that, you're again looking at something that can be turned or could be turned into diplomatic incidents. And again, I go back and I say what Tom said is absolutely true. Look at the time, what was happening in Russia. They were not in any situation, both in terms of intelligence operations, what was happening economically in Russia at the time. I mean, this was I call it the true chaos period in Russia. My husband and I went to Russia in 1992, and we lived there about a year. And we were working with a couple of children hospital to bring in these aides to the hospital. Like, Russia didn't have incubators, okay? This was, I mean, we were shocked. We went to Russia, and St. Petersburg, the largest hospital, children hospital in St. Petersburg, with 700 rooms, they did not have incubators. So almost all their premature babies were dying, because simply they didn't have incubators in Russia. So while we were there during this period, this was the era that a lot of these KGB guys have turned into freelance mafiosas, you know. We struck this friendship with this couple who had just set up a little shop there in St. Petersburg. And what they were doing is they were going to Finland, and their plan was to bring in these, you know, more fancier food items, grocery items, and have one of the first Westernish grocery shop market in St. Petersburg. One day before they opened the shop, if some of these KGB turned mafias, they showed up and they said, okay, you need to give us this much money so that we can protect you and you open it. Otherwise, we won't let you open. And they started begging the couple. They're saying, please let us open and operate so that we have the money so we can give it to you. Right now, we don't have any money. Well, that same evening, the mafiosa came and they broke everything and they set it on fire. So the shop didn't open. And when we were there, of course, we were every day encountering all these foreigners there, you know, Americans, Brits, Germans. It was this period of time that, like vultures, everybody was in Russia. It was, you know, how can we take this real estate and grab it while it's cheap, but while they could sell it, because this is going to be prime 8 years from now. There were people who were going to Lada manufacturer. This is the Lada car that Russia produces, and they wanted to take a piece of that. This was when Russia was basically dumbfounded. This has happened. Everybody's in shock as far as the population goes, okay? It's like, what now? It hasn't figured out what is it going to be, you know, from all these half a century of communism, and then suddenly it's over. And this time period was when they were trying to find somehow their footing, okay? So that's why I'm saying it's very important what Tom just said. And this arrest and this detainment occurred, took place during this time period. So we have to put it within the context, which he just did. And to that, I just added the fact that when you're looking at figures like this, Ayman al-Zawahiri, it was not only regular 3-4 passports or fake passports. Ayman al-Zawahiri has had diplomatic passports, as Osama bin Laden did, as Abdullah Çatlı did. If you look at the top figures or even some of the mid-level figures there, you are going to see that, interestingly, they possess diplomatic passports. It may not be American diplomatic passports, but another NATO member nation. It may be Turkish diplomatic passports. It may be a Belgian diplomatic passports. It may be French diplomatic passports. But that is also a fact that needs to be noted there. And then another point you mentioned that I was going to talk about, and I totally forgot what it was. After we talked about that, Pierce, you mentioned something that seemed that sounded very, very interesting. But if I remember, I'll jump in.
the other character from Azerbaijan, maybe?
Well,
one thing I was just going to quickly add there is that, when exactly was Zawahiri arrested, Pierce? You must have this in your notes.
It was late 1996 because he wasn't released until 1997.
August, September 1996.
Okay, so that is also about the time, and this may not be quite so important, but I just thought I'd bring it up. That's pretty much the same time that Putin first becomes Prime Minister of Russia. Not president.
I think that's quite important.
I mean, not in the sense of Putin himself individually, but what Putin represents. He represents, sure, you know, the re-rise of the deep state, the Russian deep state, the KGB, all of that. As did Lenin before him, I would argue. Sure. But we won't get into that. So I think that's another little bit of context that tells you something. You know, why was Zawahiri arrested then specifically? Mm. Well, it's partly because that's the point at which I think the Russian deep state felt, right, now we've got our hands back on the tiller. Now we've got this under our control again. Now let's start, you know, looking at what else is going on. Because, like I say, they didn't have the intelligence capacity in 1993 to go and start infiltrating Al-Qaeda and things like that. It was only the CIA and MI6, you know, who could do that at that time. So that wasn't a battle they could fight. So they had to, you know, fight it in a different way. And as we've seen it, as time's gone on, they have become, you know, just a little bit more aggressive as their state has become more economically stable and more politically strong. You know, Iraq, they didn't do anything. But when it came to Syria a few years later, and Syria was very important to them because it is their warm water port, it is their entrance to the Mediterranean, militarily as well as economically, they stood up and they said, no, we're not having it. We're not letting this happen. And then they, you know, they staged this ludicrous chemical attack story, which I'm still not quite sure what really happened there, but it certainly wasn't what they said. And Russia had a contingency plan. They said, okay, we will assist Assad in getting rid of his chemical stockpiles and sell him some weapons to replace them with. And therefore, you can go away and there isn't a problem and NATO doesn't have to invade. So they'd clearly seen this possibility coming. And so, once again, they had a contingency plan in place. And I think the same thing in Ukraine. And I think, once again, what's happening recently, it seems that NATO has got OPEC to crash the oil price to try and drain Russia out and try and cause them economic problems. And it is working to some extent. How have Russia responded? They've said they're no longer going to ship gas through Ukraine, and now they're going through Turkey, which is quite a hostile move, one might say. Again, not a military move, but their agenda and the point that they're making is quite clear, I would say. This is the Russian strategy, as I see it.
Oh, yeah, and I think also in that, you know, that late 90s period, I mean, Chechnya was not anywhere near as stable as it is today. I mean, you know, I mean, the whole entire city of Grozny had to be rebuilt, and this is coming, you know, just a few years before the second Chechen war. So obviously Russia is not trying to, confront a particular group that they think might be behind much of their problems there. So yeah, again, context is always important. And as you were saying just there, Tom, I mean, they do have a contingency plan always. I'm not sure how, strategic this recent deal with Turkey with South Stream will be, but because it certainly puts Turkey in a very powerful position economically and geopolitically. But Sibel, anything else before we kind of move on to what's going on currently in this region?
Yeah, quickly, I just remembered what was the point I was going to mention. You mentioned briefly, both of you, Afghanistan and the importance of Afghanistan. Basically, we now have a permanent base in Afghanistan, and the importance is in so many folds that is just unbelievable in terms of why Afghanistan is so extremely important. Of course, logically, a lot of people would think of Iran. Okay, you're looking at Afghanistan right there. And as we said, we are surrounding all areas with Iran. You're looking at Iraq, basically, semi-down, our base, Afghanistan. And then you look at the border area when you're looking at Sistan and Baluchistan, you're looking at the most important region where Gladio has been very, very active. And it was, as it was later became known, in one of the headquarters of Al-Qaeda operations. And some of their key figures were in Sistan and Baluchistan, and it still is for the U.S. You know, this is the porous border region that is extremely important. So it's logical, and most people would deduce who is paying attention that, okay, Afghanistan is really important in terms of Iran. That's right. Afghanistan more so is important in terms of China, because when we later maybe talk about Xinjiang, when we look at the arteries and the potential pipeline projects that would get the energy resources from Iran to China, you would look at it as a very, very, very strategically important area. And in terms of China, it's far more important for the United States than it is for in terms of Iran. And this is the area that we are going to hear about so much in the coming years, and it's going to start trickling, which has been trickling, all the stuff that we hear on Xinjiang and the Uyghurs and the East Turkestan, etc. It's going to get more heated, that whole area. And again, if you look at Xinjiang, the most important aspect of Xinjiang is being where it is. So whether you're bringing the resources for China, if you're bringing it from, let's say, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, or if you're looking at in terms of Iran, you are looking at the highly important strategic location. So if Xinjiang, for example, one of the operations we have had against Russia has to do what we are doing in terms of supporting Tibet's monks, etc. I mean, I mentioned it during my interview just a couple of days ago, but, you know, Richard Gere coming and having his Oscar scene about, you know, how we should show solidarity. Well, what they are doing in terms of, they don't give a damn about the monks and the minorities. We have never given a damn about any minorities. It's never about minorities. It's only when we can exploit it, when we can utilize it towards, on the chessboard, towards our competitor, our opponent. And in this case, the monks and the Tibet has only one role, that against Russia. Because of the, again, but in terms of geographic location, that is nothing compared to Xinjiang. It's far more, this is way above the Tibet region, because whoever controls the arteries, the pipelinistan, is going to be the superpower. And if we have three layers of superpowers, being the number one superpower. And I know they are still discussing the Gwadar port, you know, bringing it, you know, the energy resources from Iran. And then the beneficiaries, of course, would be Pakistan and China. I just can't see that happen. Pakistan is under whose rule? Okay. Again, Pakistan is another unofficial base that we have, in addition to being one of the nuclear nations with the nuclear weapons. But that is not going to happen. And China knows this. Okay. And so Xinjiang becomes extremely important. And in the middle of all this, when you again go back to the map and look at Afghanistan, you see, okay, in terms of China, it's number one importance. In terms of Iran, it's number two importance. Number three importance, again, not many people talk about it, is Afghanistan, even after the Russians withdrew, became Russia's domain for the opium, okay? And the amount was still meager, but for Russian economy, it was significant. You're looking at somewhere around $5 to $10 billion range. When you look at it, we also removed that from Russia. That was a source of income, and it's not a meager income. And we expanded it to be today, they are putting the value of the opium there in the range of $100 to $300 billion. I mean, when you look at these amounts, you're not looking at some peanuts here. And that was number three, and that was to have the artery for the opium, for the narcotics trade, and we completely removed that from the Russians. They had it until after 9/11. Russia was the beneficiary of, I would, if I were to throw a number, 80% plus of that revenue, and the control of the transportation, and then the export of it. But today, Russia basically has no share. It is completely operated from, you know, with the operatives such as Turkey is extremely important. And even now, they don't even have to go through the long route of ground route bringing in. They are doing a lot of it even with the airplanes, military airplanes, as we have done it before with Vietnam. But that is another big importance of Afghanistan. So Afghanistan is extremely important, extremely important. And of course, with 9/11, we got the green light to say we have the semi-justification. This is where we're going to go. This is where we're going to take over. And it is an unofficial base. And Pakistan is one of our unofficial base. You know, people are talking about where we have actual formal official military base, but they are not counting these nations as bases. They are bases.
Oh, and I mean, and that's just, you know, on that note, I mean, that's the case all over the African continent. While there's one, quote, official base in Djibouti, there are, you know, I mean, thousands upon thousands of small military bases, you know, particularly in Congo, where, you know, we claim we have no troops. There are, you know, just tens and tens of bases all over that that country alone, not to mention the rest of Africa. So, yeah, of course, I mean, you don't need to have an official military base anywhere. But moving on to some of the kind of ramping up of Gladio operations, because much of what we've been discussing previously has been, you know, sort of in the past a little bit, but we're starting to see a kind of new maybe, you know, next level of Gladio going on, and particularly within Chechnya, which has been, for the past several years, a fairly stable, calm you know, political environment. But with just in the past few months, we've seen several large-scale attacks in the capital, in Grozny. And of course, as Chechnya, you know, was pacified by Kadyrov and the power of Russia, the general violence just spread to the surrounding regions, Dagestan being a major one. But this does kind of seem like part of a kind of overall effort to kind of, you know, jazz up the Chechen militants, if you want to say. And just recently, me and Christoph were talking on our podcast about a, quote, prediction from the president of the Brookings Institute, Strobe Talbot, who's a former Clinton State Department official, who, as I said, predicted, in air quotes, that a third Chechen war could start very soon. And both me and Christoph said that this wasn't a prediction so much as an announcement. Now, how solid this new operation is sort of difficult to gauge. By and large, the population in Chechnya really doesn't buy much of the Western propaganda. There was a recent poll that was conducted where, you know, almost the entire population of Chechnya believed that, you know, most of the Chechen insurgents are funded by the West, if not, you know, directly by NATO. So it'll be difficult. But obviously, the Gladio operation, you know, network is intent on bringing Chechnya back. And of course, they're linking lots of these ISIS terrorists with Chechnya. And even that is sort of murky at best. There was a recent article I saw on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, with Ilya Rogachev, who's a Russian foreign minister for the Department of New Challenges and Threats, which is an odd choice. But he recently claimed that most of these Chechen ISIS fighters are, in fact, U.S.-trained Georgians. And this, of course, Georgia is such a major component of NATO's new strategy. But I guess, you know, let's just sort of open this up and kind of see, you know, what is going on? How likely is this? And, you know, while it is difficult to gauge, I do think that there is a more sort of direct approach going on right now in Chechnya. And, of course, Ramzan Kadyrov is, you know, so popular. He's known all over the world now, and he's certainly, you know, extremely popular within Russia. So we'll have to see how this is all going to play out. And of course, they will bring back Al-Qaeda every once in a while when it, you know, fits their narrative. Obviously, with this recent attack in France, suddenly this was, you know, Anwar al-Awlaki from the grave conducting this attack. And I think that the sort of Al Qaeda connection has much more to do with the geopolitical situation going on in Yemen than anything else. But of course, ISIS, there really is no ideology or goal for ISIS. They just seem intent on killing everybody with no goal in mind. They don't even really seem to be fighting Assad anymore. They're too busy murdering Christians, Yazidis, Shia. You know, gay people, you name it, basically, ISIS is after everybody. So I do wonder if, you know, Chechnya is so ingrained in many people's minds, and there is a very large network within the deep state conducting Chechen operations. So this seems like a much more plausible sort of a group to work with. You can kind of just turn them on, so to speak, and they'll just sort of go with it. So, you know, I guess how do we see this going on? And Tom, if you want to pick up on that, go right ahead.
Well, the thing that I find really confusing about all of this is which side are we supposed to be on? Are we supposed to be pro-Chechen terrorism or anti-Chechen terrorism? Because they don't seem to be able to make their mind up on that. As to whether these people are terrorists or, you know, independence-seeking freedom fighters. And I know that's kind of like the usual story with Islamic terrorism. I mean, you take the Kosovo Liberation Army. They were added and taken off the State Department's official list of terrorist organizations, like, 12 times. And this was sometimes it would be like they'd be added to it, and then literally a couple of months later, they're, oh, no, no, we're taking them off again. Now they're freedom fighters again. Oh, no, 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 now they're terrorists. Oh, no, 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 now the freedom. Oh, no, now they're narcotics shippers. Oh, right, that definitely means they're terrorists. Oh, no, no, it doesn't. No, sorry about that. No, no. And so it doesn't surprise me that we see this with the latest kind of incarnation of this, with ISIS and this supposed link to Chechnya. But, well, okay, here's one question that I just wanted to fire at you, Sibel. The Beslan school siege, this horrible incident that happened in, was it, I think it was 2004. Do you think that was a NATO Gladio B operation?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Because I'm not by any means an expert on that event. I've not looked into it in any great detail, so I don't have a strong opinion on it. I had a feeling that was what you were going to say. Okay, fair enough.
Well, it is one of the most important thing is if we look at the modus operandi here, and then we go back a little bit further and look at the British way of operations, which is more so in effect with many of these moves and events and the operations we see than I would say American style. In the end, you're looking at the strategy that says we want, you know, as you know, we did in the historically with Africa, we would like to redraw the map, you know, like you said with KSA, it's like, you know, some things I don't like this. Why don't we take our little marker and redraw this? And we redraw the map of the continent Africa in such a way that would increase the internal wars and chaos, because the maps are drawn, the borders are drawn along the conflict lines, and based on that, the advantage of this is when you're looking at empires, any kind of empires, you do not want to face strong, unified, sovereign nations. And what you do is you utilize everything that you can see along the religious, ethnic, race lines, tribal lines, to make sure that there is ongoing, unstoppable conflict and chaos on the ground. Therefore, thus, weaker nations are much easier to control and rule than the strong nations. I know it's very simplistic, but when you look at, again, the areas here, of course, we've been watching the events unfolding in Ukraine. And of course, we have this big prize right now there, Georgia. And I keep telling people, you have to keep your eyes. The next things that you're going to see after Ukraine is going to be Georgia. Okay. So with the collapse of the Soviet Union, what did we do? You know, we saw that, okay, we have this Soviet being broken apart, we have these so-called independent states, okay? What we couldn't do during the Soviet era, that was when we started doing, and that is, take over Azerbaijan, do this with Kyrgyzstan, do this with Azerbaijan and Ukraine and Georgia. And in Europe, with Eastern Europe, we were not even happy the way things were. Let's break them apart even further, okay? And that was what we were looking at during the Balkan Wars, you know, with Kosovo. And what happened? You know, there we don't have any longer like Czechoslovakia, you know, what happened to Yugoslavia? And break it into smaller units, okay? And then start taking over. And look at how many of them became NATO members, right? And same thing, you're looking at Iraq. The ultimate end for Iraq is three Iraqs. There's going to be a completely different autonomous region, which is currently not possible because of Turkey factor, that is going to be Kurdistan in northern Iraq. Then you have the Sunni Iraq in the center, and then you have the Shia Iraq in the south, and each one of them being, you know, start redrawing and borders and becoming smaller chunks and nations, thus easier controllable. So once we are done with the primary initial prizes, which we are, you know, Azerbaijan, Ukraine, Georgia, Kyrgyzstan, etc., then it is to take and have this break into further units. I mean, currently, Chechens are Russian nationals, okay? You have Chechnya and you have Dagestan. Okay, they have the names as regions, but they are not states. The ultimate goal is, when you're looking at the chessboard, is to have a Chechnya as a nation, as a small nation. It's no longer part of Russia, and it's right there within the borders. You're even closer to your competitor, to your opponent. Mm-hmm. And to have Dagestan as a separate nation, to have Xinjiang. You know, with China, it was, you know, the importance of Taiwan. And what is, you know, what has Hong Kong become? This goes back hundreds of years. This is the British strategy. This is the imperial strategy of, so that's the importance of, not only in terms of utilizing the Chechen separatists as terrorists and for some mission, maybe within Syria or along the border. And again, they're going to play a pretty important role when we start seeing things heating up in Georgia. And the tension between Georgia and Russia, it's coming. It's coming, and it's coming shortly. But more so, it's a long-term strategy that hopefully for the empire, hopefully we will see a gradual move towards having more states created that currently don't exist as so-called sovereign nations to take over, and that is to have a separate nation, Chechnya and Dagestan. That's exactly what the goal of empire is. And as long as we get that, and as long as we utilize the chaos and the tension along the ethnic lines and the religious lines, we happen to be the winners because it is utilized against our competitors. And then maybe later we'll get into China. China's modus operandi is so different than Russia. And economically, we are looking at a totally different paradigm with China than we are looking with Russia.
Well, Tom, I thought your question about are the Chechens good or bad is really interesting, because obviously they're not really one or the other, and it is one of those sort of sick questions where, you know, oh well, like take the recent shooting incident in Grozny, you know. I'm sure there were many people here in the West that are like, oh, well, who gives a shit? I mean, it's just the Russians, you know, it was just cops that got killed. You know, mm-hmm. Kadyrov yeah. is, you know, walks around like a thug, more or less. I mean, I believe he only had a high school education. And for all of his pronouncements about Islam, he's, you know, he's never quoted like a surah from the Quran or anything like that. But at the same time, the sort of Islam that is practiced in Chechnya is the kind of Islam that, you know, we, meaning, you know, the West, claims to love. This is like a fairly moderate version of Sufism. It's fairly open. You know, there's no crazy sort of, you know, Sharia type pronouncements going on in Chechnya. You know, women don't have to walk around in a niqab. I don't even believe they necessarily need to wear a hijab, but I'm not totally positive on that. So it is an interesting back and forth. And I don't know if you want to kind of expand on that anymore, because I think it is actually a really interesting topic to be discussing. You know, how are we supposed to feel about that? And of course, along what Sibel was just saying, that we would like to create some sort of, you know, autonomous Chechen state. I mean, is that, you know, if we did that, would then we be flooding over there and propping it up and, you know, building, I don't know, Gulen-style mosques all over the place?
Sure. Absolutely, because Gulen-style mosques and madrasas are being currently advertised and promoted as the moderate Islam. Mm. And it's not so much as... that's exactly where we are headed with Chechnya. And of course, it is that. And then within a few years, lo and behold, we have another candidate that had put its request, its form, its application for NATO candidacy. Mm. You know, basically, we want... 90% of the world is going to be NATO members. That's right, or 99%. We are expanding because now we know that NATO officially has, I don't know what they call it. I call it the satellite base, because NATO, I mean, even by its name, it was supposed to be North Atlantic. And then, you know, after Eastern Europe, Central Asia, Caucasus, And then NATO satellite partners, when you're looking at United Emirates and Kuwait, and these are NATO satellite offices. So they have some kind of a membership. You know, it's like you have platinum level with the credit cards and the gold level. So theirs is like still in that, they haven't reached the platinum. They're in the silver level NATO membership. And then we're going to expand it with, you know, with the African nations. It's just like cosmetic name that is North Atlantic Treaty Organization, but it's NATO, but it is empires, and then say this is the empire fronts for the West, and here are the, you know, two, one of the major one being China, and the other one we will see is Russia. And then again, maybe if we have time left over, if not this time, next time, we will talk about the importance of Russian nationalism and the long-term goal for Russia. The scariest, the biggest threat for U.S. is, you know, and has been since the fall of Soviet Union, is the Russian nationalists, okay? And some of it you overcome by having leaders that you're comfortable with. You know, we have been comfortable with all of them because we had a role in their existence, you know, whether you're looking at Yeltsin or before that group after Yeltsin, and you're looking at right now Putin, which is going to be one of our topics, if not this time, next time. They are not what I consider or term as nationalists. No. So that's one way, is through the leaders, the prime ministers, the operatives, that even the financial moguls within Russia, those play important roles, of course. But the other thing is time, and that is, okay, this took place in 1991, 1992. We are looking at, it's over 20 years has passed. It's the gradual McDonaldization, that's what I would call it, of Russia. Because you're looking at a generation of Russia that's going to disappear. So that threat is going to get to be reduced when you're looking at the new generation Russians and compare them to those nationalists that right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, after going through the initial shock, they are looking at things and they are disgusted. And that's a significant percentage there, not majority, but it is significant enough. 10, 15, 20 years from now, a lot of them are not going to be around. Therefore, based on that, some of our tactics are going to change. But Russia is going internally through its McDonaldization. I don't know if any of you, either of you, have been to Russia recently, but when you really go there and you look at the commerce there, you look at the stores there, you look at the schooling, you look at the cafes, restaurant, music, you see that it's going to be a totally different Russia with a almost non-existent percentage of the old-time nationalists. And we are still waiting out that time period, thus the sensitivity and importance of keeping people like Putin in place. And importance of leaders that we are comfortable with, I'm not saying we possess them 100%, is to play the game for those leaders that to a certain degree pacifies that leftover old-time nationalists in Russia. We're not going to worry about it that much because they, unfortunately, I mean, we die. and they're not going to be able to bite. They're not going to have much teeth left in another 10, 15 years with their dentures. But that is the risk that we are playing it so that it is contained. And Putin has to contain that percentage of the population, the nationalists. And that is, he has to bark, and sometimes bark very, very loud. Otherwise, I mean, think about it. It's, you are going to see mobilization of that, however a small percentage of the old-timer Russian nationalists. And he's been playing that very, very good. Because even when you look at it from the, you know, from this side, from our side, you say, oh, yeah, I mean, there are people, our activists here, they're saying, hooray, look, he's being tough. Actually, he's our hope to contain our imperial power here, because we went from, you know, bipolar world to unipolar world. But that's the surface. That's the cosmetic. It's a smart play that pleases the Western powers, is for Russia to play it that way. And that's true even, you know, with Middle East. When we have puppet regimes, and our puppet regimes, usually look how the leaders of these puppet regimes that we install once in a while have to bark very loud about Israel, even though they are serving Israel. Yeah. But to contain the population, I mean, it's even true for Turkey. It gets this standing ovation and hooray from people when the Turkish leaders can say it's not tolerable and we are going to have some sort of cosmetic sanction in our relationship with Israel for doing that. If they weren't, I mean, if they didn't do that, then you are going to have this uproar and saying you are too obviously a Western puppet. You are too obviously against the Muslims' interests or this geographically, this particular strategic location's interest, you're completely Western. So that has to be present. Israel loves it when Saudi Arabia, you know, the Saudi Arabia prince and kings and whatever, they are getting up and they are just talking and saying really tough stuff about Israel. I mean, it's part of the game. They have to play it in order to maintain their role. You know, you have given these roles to these characters on this stage in the theater, and they have to maintain that. And when some unexpected stuff happens, they have to improvise, but they have to act within what is scripted for their characters. And if they act outside that, the audience is going to say, uh-huh, this is not a good actor. Well, in this case, in the world, it's going to be, no, we don't want this. And you have much higher chance of population mobilizing, saying we want regime change, than having puppets and having partners that can play the game right and keep them content and pacify that, don't give them the reason to have the uprising. And let's say in case of Russia, don't give the reason for nationalism or the nationalists and the few leaders that they have left over to get their voice heard and start screaming loudly and get to be heard by their followers. And Putin has been doing a fantastic job keeping them content. And of course, the beneficiaries of that happen to be us, the U.S. empire.
Mm. Tom, you want to pick up on anything there?
Well, just to go back to before what you were saying about Chechnya. And I mean, when I was asking the question, which side are we supposed to be on in this, you know, attempt by NATO? I mean, clearly that is the long term strategy, is to start balkanizing, if you like, Russia's southern border. And Chechnya and Dagestan would presumably only be the start of that. Presumably they would try and continue that all the way along, you know, to the Pacific. But anyway, what I was going to say was that I was kind of asking it sort of as a joke in terms of, you know, how is the media playing this? How is the popular mainstream press trying to convince us to, you know, which side are we supposed to be picking in this? And it was never particularly clear to me whenever I read mainstream press coverage of Chechnya. But from the perspective of what I, you know, me, you, Sibel, think, what side should we be on? that's not an easy question for me to answer, because part of me says it might actually be good for the Chechen people to have their own state. You might think that's a bit kind of hippy-dippy liberal of me, but I do always feel a certain affinity with these kinds of independence movements. I do always feel a certain obligation to at least support them in spirit to some extent. Even if they are part of a strategy that I completely oppose, as you know. So, I suppose I'm asking that as a question, actually. How do you two feel about that?
I think it totally depends on the outcome. For this topic came up. For example, there are people who say, my God, you don't have any sympathy towards these people who have been actually oppressed by the Chinese regime in Xinjiang. Of course I do.
Yeah.
You have to, I keep telling them, and you have to separate the general population. I think, has China been oppressing and abusing the Muslims, the Uyghurs there in Xinjiang? Absolutely. Have they committed some, you know, significant level atrocities there? Absolutely. However, what happens is when you look at the competing power saying, I'm going to utilize this for my own benefit, and in the end, once I have utilized it, and let's say I have it separated, then I'm going to plant my own puppet to rule this place and govern it. You're looking at the population is still going to be oppressed. You know, think about Saudi Arabia. Okay, think about any of the countries that we have puppetized by taking over and putting there. Which one of these nations in that part of the world would you consider democratic, where people are, you know, Saudi Arabia? Of course, our media is not playing at all how they are stoning women, how they are beheading people, how they are giving them the leash, how they are torturing them and detaining them without any due process. Well, Saudi Arabian regime is a very, very oppressive dictatorial regime that we have installed. We are keeping in power with our military. And if Saudi is sovereign, right? So in the end, it would be like comparing and saying, well, which would they be better off this way, Saudi Arabia, which is horrible, or that way, which is horrible, and then having to decide the degree of horribility, you know, to say which one is the lesser of the two evils. And again, it's we don't know until it happens. And then see, are they, you know, in general, as a, you know, whole, better off this way, or are they better off that way? And again, that totally depends on that. And then that also goes very similar, even though it's not related to the topics we are talking about, how people justify, let's say, voting in the United States. They're saying, well, we know they are both serving the same system. But let's decide who is more evil. If Obama ranks 99.2 on the degree of evilness and McCain ranks 94.6 in the degree of, you know, evilness, we better all go and vote for Obama. And talking about this slight variation in the degree, in the end, we have voted for an evil that is serving the same evil system. So really doesn't change the outcome. And again, the people who are paying the price are the world, is the world population. And of course, it's our own people here in this country. This is similar. So it's very hard to say, well, would they be better off as an independent nation and without, you know, sovereign. I'm looking at the population, let's say, in places like Kyrgyzstan, okay? Are they really better off? It's really hard to measure. If you were to compare Kyrgyzstan when it was a Soviet state versus today what Kyrgyzstan is, you would have a hard time determining, are they better off, the Kyrgyz population, than they were part of the Soviet Union? Same thing with Azerbaijan. I was looking at the amount of money the Azerbaijan government spent before it became NATO candidate. Its candidacy was accepted by NATO. And versus today, the jump is something like several million percent. I mean, they are required, this is Azerbaijan, to spend this amount, which is in billions and billions of dollars, in procurement, military procurement. The beneficiaries are the French and the Germans and the Americans. As part of the acceptance, so their candidacy is totally approved and they are considered qualified, so stamp goes there. Look at the beneficiaries there. Now, this money, where does this money come from in Azerbaijan that was not spent? You know, and then now it's like several million times more, billions and billions of dollars. And when you look at the prisons in Azerbaijan or in Kyrgyzstan, you know, or in Kazakhstan, and start saying, how is it compared to what it was during the Soviet Union era when they were not independent states? It becomes this, I don't know, it's hard to say, well, between the two evil, this is better. And so usually I don't even consider it that way. I say it's just a matter of being used and abused in the end, and you're abused one way or another, and no matter what the degree is, unless the degree is so significant that we'd say, sure, this and this and this, however, you know, they are better off because the degree of difference is really significant enough to determine that. So, yeah, I don't have an answer for that. That's the short answer.
Well, let me rephrase it slightly then, because the way I see it with Chechnya in particular doesn't make a huge amount of difference which way we feel about it. The strategy is going to play out, and one way or another what's going to happen in Chechnya is going to happen there. And you're right, I'm not in any way really making the argument that it would be better for them to be a NATO puppet state than it would be to be a sort of abused micro state of Russia. So if the question is not whether it be, in terms of whether it makes any difference what we would prefer to see happen in Chechnya, because I don't think we really have much control over it, the three of us. So I suppose the question is more, yeah, for me, it's a kind of a more of an abstract kind of spiritual question. And in that sense, I would tend, like I say, to come down on the side of, I would actually rather see, spiritually speaking, I suppose philosophically speaking, I would actually rather see lots and lots of microstates, because, but I would apply that, of course, in my own country, and I would apply that to the United States, and I would apply that everywhere, because I just think it would be better off if you had lots of little countries and you didn't have any great big countries. But no, when you have great big countries, yeah, you're right, it will play out like it played out in Eastern Europe. You will have, you know, Britain, France and Germany are the big states, and everywhere else gets chopped up into smaller pieces so that they can't really fight back. Yeah, I know. I see where you're coming from, Sibel. I'm just.
Sometimes I ask this question. For example, I would like to get both of your views on that. Do you think, as a whole, the world was better off? In both cases, you're looking at empire, so it's been really effed up for so long. Comparing evil. But do you think, as a whole, we were all, as a whole, the world in general, was better off under the bipolar system or since the fall of the Soviet Union as a unipolar system? In terms of, if we start adding up the number of, let's say, deaths and conflicts, both the small conflicts along the borders, ethnic conflicts within micronations, but also as a general, you know, worldwide wars, major wars that we are carrying out, including the so-called war on terrorism and the terrorism, and take into consideration all the stuff with the so-called Al-Qaeda, the CIA made the ISIS, CIA made Al-Qaeda. And if you put all of these elements, what do you guys think? Do you think we were better off 30 years ago as a whole? Humanity suffered more or less? What do you think?
Well, I think that is a great question, though, and it is something that you do wonder. I guess that my initial response would be that, at least in the bipolar world, there were at least more than one option. Obviously, both of them were pretty horrible, I would say, you know, more or less. The Soviets or the United States, I mean, it's sort of just two sides of the same coin. So I don't know. I mean, I think that in the sort of unipolar world, it might be worse in that when there isn't a real enemy, this mythical all-encompassing enemy is created. So, you know, a la Al-Qaeda, now ISIS, you know, Boko Haram in Africa. I mean, there's a whole litany of these, you know, shadowy organizations that come up. So I guess, I mean, in the unipolar world, it just seems more this sort of like, I don't even know, this sort of almost like a cult, you know, we're all going to die and from that will, you know, rise the phoenix that will be, I don't know, NATO or something, or, you know, some crazy sort of, it seems very focused upon death and destruction. Whereas in the sort of bipolar world, at least you might have had a, you know, there was some other option, or at least you could kind of go your own. And of course, I think in the bipolar world, there was the non-alignment movement meant a whole lot more. And obviously that became co-opted and certain groups were propped up within the non-alignment movement, like the Tutsis in Rwanda, which, you know, did all sorts of horrific things later. But I guess I would just want to live in a complete, you know, sort of what Tom was saying, in just a, you know, a huge, I don't know, multipolar world with many, many different little actors, and perhaps with that, then there wouldn't be quite so many problems. But I mean, then we're getting into this very philosophical argument, which I would, you know, love to have as well. And I just a quick comment. It's really funny. In the alternative media, there is a lot of maybe what we would say faux anarchists that will, you know, harp on about certain groups, you know, say here in America, where, you know, they believe that, you know, every single state should be an individual country. And I'm not opposed to that idea at all if it was, you know, actually real, or perhaps being, you know, directed in the right way. And they'll talk about the, you know, the Basque people in Spain. They'll talk about the Palestinians. They'll talk about all these groups. But then when it comes to certain countries, you know, such as Russia or China, they love these massive, you know, all-encompassing big government states. They love the state when it comes to Russia. And it is that interesting sort of argument where you do it, you know, and I sympathize with you, Tom, in obviously it probably, you know, isn't totally great living in Chechnya. And a quick note to that, one of the few Chechen activists who strongly believed in creating an independent Chechnya, but completely opposed radical Islam or the perversion of Muslim practices in order to achieve this and wanted to do this through a political means, Medet Onlu, who also opposed the jihadist highway to Syria, was, of course, murdered, probably not by the FSB, but by Turkey. For various reasons. So, you know, interesting that the few independent leaders, which is something I've talked about many times on the show, if you're really independent, believe me, you're not going to last very long in this unipolar world. So, but Tom, I don't know.
That applies to us, by the way. You know that, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
As the truly independent outlets, and I have that philosophical discussions all the time, when you are not aligning yourself with the left or the right, or the general stereotype, you know, the indirect propaganda style, you can count the number of these types of alternative medias and not use both your hands that I'm aware of. Maybe in other languages, they are out there in the blogosphere, because you're right. They won't let you breathe. I mean, you have to align one way or another with the major the fronts out there. You're right. Go ahead. Sorry about interrupting you.
It's all right. Well, okay, I have three different answers to your question, Sibel. The first is that 30 years ago, I would have been only a couple of years old and Pierce wouldn't have even been born yet.
Yeah.
So, we're not perhaps the best people to make a judgment about that, because we just haven't lived long enough. But my second answer is thinking... I mean, I was going to phrase the question in terms of Russia. Was Russia better off under the Tsarist system, under the Soviet Union, or now? Hard to say. It's a very, very difficult question. I don't know if it would have made a huge amount of difference. The third answer, I agree with Pierce. I think it was better under the bipolar system, because at least there was somewhere to defect to. I mean, now who do you defect to? There's no one to defect to anymore. I always liked a good old defection. It kind of, you know, shakes things up a bit. It's like if you're really stuck in your life, you can't think what else to do. At least you could defect to the other side and get something out.
I mean, seriously, even with countries, you know, a few years ago before we changed our city, we were looking into moving to New Zealand, because I was saying, well, in general, among some of they have this and this better. They still haven't done this thing with their airport, so they're kind of holding off. And as we were looking into it, they made this agreement, and they struck this agreement with NSA. Then they said they are going to participate in the invasion of, I forgot, which one was it? The And then I said, there it goes. The Australia I would never consider. They have been the butler nation for a long time. But you're so right. Even within, I mean, there is... Everything has become so uniform that you can't find any alternative, saying, if I want to relocate and go to a different country, when you're looking at, you know, within Europe, let's say, Germany, France, Italy, and then you look at Australia, it's like, where the hell can you go? Just to get away from this national security state and the surveillance, now is uniformly applicable to basically all of these Western nations, at least. And then I have heard people talking about, oh yeah, well, I'm going to go to Venezuela or Cuba, and who knows what's going to happen with Cuba. I'm like, I think we are losing Cuba lately with what's happening. But no, I agree with you. And the other important thing, I think, is that things were more tangible. It was not this abstract, which is really leads to perpetual wars. And that is, okay, the enemy was declared to be Soviet Union, and we could have said, okay, they have this many warheads, and this is their border, we have this, and then things had to be compromised, and then the two basically kept each other to a certain degree in check. So even though with that doomsday prophecy and everything that was out there was it came with some sort of a tangible limits, and that was removed with introducing 9/11 and by having the unipolar world and having these enemies that you can't define. They are borderless. As we have talked about before, we don't know the count. So Al-Qaeda army, the supporters are what? They are 5 million or they may be 50 of them or 5,000 of them. Because invisible. There is such an abstract concept they have created. Al-Qaeda did it. Al-Qaeda, they don't have any bases. There is no nation. There are no borders. There is no countable. ISIS. Or we killed Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Do you get IDs that says they were Al-Qaeda member? Okay, they killed Al-Qaeda. They can come after us. And they can put us in jail and they say that we were supporters of Al-Qaeda. There is no way either one of us can put a defense. Okay? Well, yeah. How do you prove it? Because nobody ever even seeks proof. It has become this abstract notion. So there is no, you know, quantifying aspects of it. There is nothing tangible. Therefore, it is limitless. I mean, it can expand, become ongoing atrocious war with multi fronts, can be Syria and Libya and all the stuff put together and go on forever, because when everything about it is abstract, the end of it is abstract, which is there is no end. And therefore, I would say in terms of containability aspect of it, it doesn't exist.
Well, I think on that note, I think we're now getting into some really fascinating territory again, and we have been talking now for a little while. If anyone has any sort of last minute things, I mean, I know I had some other stuff that I wanted to get to, but perhaps this would be a good place to kind of pick up again and expand on all these things in another round table. But Tom, did you have anything else that you wanted to add?
No, not really. I think you're right. This conversation has reached another point where we've sort of answered some questions that we started with, but now we just have a whole sort of set of new questions. And perhaps that's the best place to stop it and just use those as the kickoff point next time. Yeah.
Yeah. Sibel, exactly. Anything else you want to add?
I completely agree, because this is a good place to stop, and it gives us more reason to continue. And I want to also add the fact that this is another reason I like this kind of shows, when it is true debate with perspectives and bringing the extra knowledge. Like, you know, one of the things he did a much better job articulating the importance of context and history with this and with al-Zawahiri issues. And even during the previous interviews, we never got into it, which was very, very important. The advantage of having this trio debate on that. As I announced, my podcast program is coming, and I said, I don't want to do the interview business. When you bring an expert question and he answers, I get suffocated, you know, I kind of get really bored, and it doesn't get my juice going. I don't get excited about it. I don't like the solo stuff either, I was thinking, because that kind of goes along with some guru complex. I call it guru complex. It's like, here it is, Sibel presenting her views of what's going on and interpreting and telling you this is the fact. I hate that too. This is my most, I would say, what I find most desirable, interesting, and exciting, this form of debate. So I'm game. I would love to pick this up, and we can continue anytime. I would love doing this with both of you. It's a great joy.
well, excellent. And I think that this is a great forum to kind of discuss these things. And there really is a severe lack of interesting debate on this in the alternative media. You know, it's become more and more sort of about selling a particular view. And while so many of them claim to, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm for everything. Of course, you know, you can figure out exactly who they are supporting, who's funding them and whatnot. And it's really this sort of true independent alternative media that we need to have more of. Again, I want to thank both of you so much for joining me on the show. Tom and Sibel, quickly, if you want to just throw out your websites where people can go to learn some more about both of your work. Tom, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. My main podcast is Clandestime, which you can find on YouTube and on my site, spyculture.com. And also, just a quick shout out, me and BS are doing a series which will actually feature Sibel coming this spring on the CIA and Hollywood, so keep an eye out for that.
Mm-hmm. And I'll be adding a little something post show about that as well. And Sibel, please tell everybody about your website and of course your books.
Sure. Boiling Frogs post. If it's too long to type, you can just put bfpreport.com, and that's our website. And the books, my original book, Classified Woman, Nonfiction, Biography, and The Lone Gladio was released recently. TheLoneGladio.com is the website. And an interesting note here, most of the sales for the book so far, for both of you, have been coming from UK. UK is number one country for both print and Kindle edition. And believe me or not, the second country is Denmark. And it may say something about the literacy rate, or maybe people were after getting engaged in some critical thinking, but I found that fascinating. And it was great to be with you, both of you. Thank you.
Of course. Okay, everybody, so that about does it for this episode of Porkins Policy Radio. If you enjoyed this podcast and you would like to hear some more of my work, then please visit porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. And there, of course, you can find all of the podcasts free for download. You can also find all of the podcasts by going to youtube.com/1138porkins. And again, if you enjoy the type of work that I do and the material I put out, then please subscribe to my YouTube channel. You can always follow through the RSS feed, through email blasts. You can definitely always follow me on Twitter, @PorkinsPolicy. And of course, if you enjoy this work, if you like this podcast, if you like the new podcast that I do with Christoph Gehrman, Porkins Great Game, then please do tell a friend about it, put it up on your social media, email it to someone, or simply just telling anybody is really, really helpful. And I appreciate all the work that the listeners do in promoting the show. Quick update. At the end of our conversation there with Sibel and Tom, Tom mentioned, of course, that me and him have a new podcast series that we'll be starting up. We're going to be dealing exclusively with the CIA and Hollywood, and we've got a whole lot of really interesting topics that we're going to be covering. We're going to be more or less picking a particular movie and discussing it, and we've got a lot of really cool guests that are going to be lined up for these different episodes, including, of course, Sibel Edmonds. I don't want to give away too much information on it, but I do want to say that I'm really excited about this new series. We should be coming out with the episodes in about 2 months or so. More or less, we're looking at about 7 episodes in this particular series right now, but of course we will be picking up the CIA and Hollywood series again after those 7, because there is so much ground to cover in terms of Hollywood and the shenanigans that are going on with the CIA there. So really good program, I think. I will, of course, be having more updates on the website. If you want some more information, you can definitely go to one of the recent episodes of Clandestime, where Tom was talking about the Titanic and some of the conspiracy theories around that, and which in and of itself was a great episode. But at the end, Tom has a little bit more information. And I will be posting up the trailer for our new podcast series on Porkins Policy Review. So definitely go and check that out. And of course, you know, I'll be updating all of the listeners through the website and through Twitter as we get closer to it. But definitely keep an eye out for this new podcast series, The CIA and Hollywood. I think my listeners, and I know Tom's listeners, are really going to get a kick out of it. And I think it's going to be really great. So that's pretty much all the updates I have. Of course, we'll have some really good episodes coming out in the near future and some great appearances. And Sibel, Tom, and I will definitely be returning to our roundtable series that we've been doing, at least in these past 2 episodes, have been really, really great. And we're definitely going to be picking this up again very soon. So again, look out for that. And I want to just thank everybody so much for listening to the show and supporting the work. And I will be talking to you very soon.